This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor dated Friday, December the 19th, 2025. As is my custom, we're going to start in the world section of today's Monitor and work our way through as many sections as we can in the time that we have. So, our first headline from today's world section reads, "In Lebanon, Hezbollah's true believers are battered, yes, but unbowed." Hezbollah has been weakened by Israel and is under pressure to disarm, but its Shiite supporters express pride in their sacrifice and look forward to revenge. And for the militia, says one analyst, keeping its arms is existential. The date on this article is December the 18th. It is by Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer at the Monitor, and the dateline is Mahruna, Lebanon. The Hezbollah's Martyrs Cemetery is perched high on the edge of the hilltop hamlet of Mahruna, with commanding views across the tree-lined hills and ravines of southern Lebanon towards the border of Hezbollah's perennial enemy, Israel. There is no sadness in the voice of Yehya Name Khalil, only pride as he speaks about his son who was buried here. A Hezbollah unit commander called Hassan, with chiseled features and a steely-eyed look, who died in an Israeli strike in May 2024. The Monitor observed that exact Israeli strike and the funeral the next day when the Hezbollah officer was buried with full military honors. "You only have to look at his face to know what kind of person he was," says Mr. Khalil, who says his son was respected in the village as a problem solver to all. Echoing his funeral eulogy, the father, a lean man with short gray hair and three traditional silver Shiite rings, one set with turquoise, says he is honored by his son's status as a martyr, killed on what this family considered to be a divine path. "I thank God for that gift," he says. The experiences and beliefs of this family of Hezbollah supporters offer rare insight into what continues to drive the Shiite militia's true believers and why they are certain that despite repeated and deep Israeli blows, Hezbollah's war against Israel will not end. There is also pride here in Mahruna because Mahruna is known as the mother of martyrs for producing more killed Hezbollah fighters per capita than any other community in Lebanon. "We used to have one martyr every 3 or 4 years, but now they come in batches of 5 or 6 at a time," says Mr. Khalil, referring to the 2 dozen graves festooned with portraits, banners, and devotional ribbons. "This village belongs to the Hezbollah resistance." In solidarity with its ally Hamas, Iran-backed Hezbollah began firing rockets into northern Israel in October 2023. The Hezbollah-Israel exchanges escalated until Israel launched a determined offensive in the fall of 2024 that wiped out Hezbollah's top leadership, killed or wounded thousands of fighters, and targeted the group's vast missile arsenal with thousands of airstrikes. Despite a ceasefire since November 2024, Israel has continued nearly daily strikes against Hezbollah targets, which Israel says is self-defense to prevent Hezbollah, long the most potent arm of Iran's regional axis of resistance alliance, from rebuilding its fighting capacity. A drone attack in Beirut in late November, for example, killed Hezbollah's top military commander, Haitham Ali Tabatabai. And the days after the Monitor's recent visit to Mahruna, Israel issued a warning that it would strike a specific building in the hamlet, told residents to keep 300 meters away, and destroyed it. The Israel Defense Force's Arabic-speaking spokesperson, Colonel Avishai Adrei, posted video of the Mahruna strikes with the words, "This is how the terrorist Hezbollah operates in your villages and stores its futile rockets in your homes and puts you in danger." The U.S.-mediated ceasefire requires Hezbollah to give up its weapons and the Lebanese army to deploy throughout the country, even in Shiite areas of southern and eastern Lebanon, which Hezbollah has ruled for decades. That disarmament has largely been achieved south of the Litani River to the border with Israel. But Hezbollah says it will not disarm further until Israel stops its strikes, until Israel withdraws from 5 outposts it still occupies inside Lebanon, also a ceasefire requirement, and after Lebanese engage in a strategic dialogue about the future. Hezbollah has been weakened, for sure, and their deterrence posture is gone, says Nicholas Blandford, a Beirut-based expert with the Atlantic Council. But they remain powerful domestically as an organization, so they can stand up to the government and say, we are not disarming. More importantly, they still pose a threat to Israel. The Israelis talk about 70% to 75% of Hezbollah's missile arsenal having been destroyed, but I think Hezbollah retains the capacity to inflict a lot of damage on Israel, says Mr. Blandford, author of Warriors of God, Inside Hezbollah's 30-Year Struggle Against Israel. Among Hezbollah's rank and file, expectations are high of imminent revenge for Israel's ceasefire strikes, at least. But so far, Hezbollah has not struck back. Their strategic patience is deeper than I would have thought 6 months ago. But in a way, it makes sense because their options are not great, says Mr. Blandford. They're able to rebuild, reorganize, and rearm despite the blows they're taking. That's evident. And the problem they face is that if they do retaliate, the Israelis are just going to come back massively. It sounds easy to say, why don't you just put down your weapons and become a political party, adds Mr. Blandford. But for Hezbollah, the weapons are the party. The resistance priority, as they call it, is the beating heart of Hezbollah. And if you take away the weapons, the rest will collapse. Hezbollah's dependence on Iranian support and logistics explains the group's position, he says. If Hezbollah were to voluntarily say, here are our weapons, we're going into politics, the Iranians would say, okay, then we're going to stop sending millions of dollars to you because you're of no use to us anymore. Hezbollah has some of its own revenue, but it's not going to be enough to sustain the massive social welfare apparatus they have, Mr. Blandford adds. Maybe they can keep a hospital here, a school there, a few guys in parliament, and a few seats in government. That could end in the next election, he adds, if the Lebanese people conclude that a disarmed and defunded Hezbollah is of little use. It's as existential for them, and they won't disarm, he says, short of a direct order from Iran. Hezbollah's leadership compares its fight against Israel with the 7th century Shiite legend of Imam Hussein, who chose to perish in the Battle of Karbala in present-day Iraq rather than surrender. We will not allow the disarmament of the resistance, and we will wage a Karbala-style confrontation, Hezbollah Secretary General Naim Qassem said in late September, describing a jihadist recovery that meant Hezbollah was ready to defend against the Israeli enemy at any time. One veteran Hezbollah operative in Beirut, who fought in Syria and gives the name Ali, offers a sober view of Hezbollah's current standing, but remains unvowed. The Israelis feel they are winning. Are they going to keep bombing? Yes. And we have to admit we did lose a lot, too, he says. Israel has high tech of all kinds, and sadly, we have a lot of traitors among us, says the gray-bearded technician, who carries a Hezbollah radio and wears a dog tag around his neck. We are sifting people right now. There are a lot who stole money and ran away. Yet retaliation against Israel, he says, is just a matter of time. If we shoot back now, our main concern is where are our people going to go for safety, Ali explains. It's going to take a little time to prepare ourselves to find a safe haven for our people, but patience has a limit with us. Everything has an end, he says, of Israel's current dominance. Victory is coming. Similar confidence radiates in Maruna, where the mosque and at least 1 in 10 houses has been destroyed by Israeli strikes. The South suffered a lot from the Israelis and their occupation, says Mr. Khalil, the slain commander's father. Almost every house in the South has wounded or martyrs. How can we give up our arms and let these criminals come and kill us? If you walk through this village now, you will not see anything but resistance fighters, agrees Mohammed Nayame, the younger brother of Commander Hassan. Somebody just killed my brother. Do you think I will give him my neck? Israel says Hezbollah is finished, but we're still here. We're still strong, adds Mr. Khalil. If it is true what they claim, that we are done, then why do they keep hitting us every day? And again, this particular article is by Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Moving on to our second headline from today's World section of The Monitor, this one reads, "With Russia looming, Europe tries to beef up its youth military service." The potential military threat from Russia and the decreasing support from the U.S. have European countries looking to conscript citizens. It's a big ask after decades of peace and prosperity. The date on this article is December the 18th. It is by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor, and the dateline is Paris. Last month, when French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled a new voluntary military program, he was met with record approval from the French public. The reaction, coming as the president's popularity is dwindling, is evidence that goes beyond politics. France is ready to defend itself. With the war in Ukraine looming just more than 1,200 miles away, there is a growing awareness in France that the nation must secure its borders in the event of Russian aggression. The £2 billion program will offer 10 months of paid military training to 18 and 19-year-olds with the goal of providing thousands of young people with domestic security skills so that France has a deep pool of reserves in the event of an armed conflict. Mr. Macron is not the only one eyeing defense. As Russia's war in Ukraine heads towards its fifth year and Europe faces the largest threats to its borders since the Cold War, leaders across the continent are taking a harder look at the strength of their militaries. But as European leaders debate the benefits of mandatory versus voluntary service, for whom and how long, they are confronting an even bigger challenge: how to show the public the value of joining the ranks. First and foremost, the goal of a military is to build defense personnel, says Jean-Claude Allard, an associate security researcher at the French Institute for International and Strategic Affairs. You can't tell young people, join the military, it's going to be a Club Med vacation. In 2017, Mr. Macron launched the National Universal Service, a military recruitment program to boost national pride and unity. The service focused on reducing delinquency among struggling French youth and building social cohesion, but did little to bolster France's defense capabilities. Now, say observers, France and Europe must reprioritize. Over the last 30 years, we've looked at our military to do everything except defense, says Martin Quenzes, managing director of strategic foresight at the German Marshall Fund of the United States in Paris. Now we are realizing that the military is not going to resolve all of society's problems. Instead, Europe's leaders are looking to bolster their professional armies and build up their reserve forces as a Russian threat becomes more imminent. On December 11th, NATO chief Mark Rutte offered a stark warning to Europe, telling leaders they must step up their defense efforts or risk war on the scale that our grandparents and great-grandparents endured. U.S. President Donald Trump earlier this month called Europe weak and threatened to pull the United States' support for Ukraine. Europe has already begun responding to those calls. This month, Belgium invited 17-year-olds to join its military for around £2,000 per month, and Germany announced it was reinstating its voluntary military service for 18-year-olds. Since 2023, the Netherlands has run a voluntary military program as well. But these countries have stopped short of making military service mandatory. For much of Western and Central Europe, conscription programs ended 25 to 35 years ago in the wake of the Cold War. Forcing young people to join the armed forces is a leap that many governments are not yet willing to make, say observers. You don't want to have to coerce anyone or end up with conscientious objectors, says Elie Tenenbaum, a security expert at the French Institute for International Relations. Reinstating military service is always a balancing act. Nearly a dozen European countries, mostly bordering Russia or Ukraine, currently run a compulsory service program. The perception of a threat from Russia has been enough to push young people to fill their military ranks. But geographical proximity is not the only reason why some military programs have been more successful than others. In Scandinavia, governments have managed to make military service part of the national ethos. In November 2024, the Swedish government sent an in-case-of-war brochure to every home in the country to teach the importance of self-sufficiency and war preparedness. It also reminded people between ages 16 and 70 of their total defense duty toward their country. The messaging worked because there is societal trust in Sweden that the government wants the right things for you, says Stephen Everts, the director of the European Union Institute for Security Studies. The government is us, not them. Around 43% of Swedes view their national government highly, above the 39% average from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Denmark and Finland also boast high levels of government trust, and though military service is compulsory there, they have not had to dip into their reserves to build troop numbers. Still, not everyone in Europe equates military duty and national pride. Germany has spent decades trying to shed its Nazi past and restyle itself as a peaceful nation. When the government announced last week that it was reinstating a voluntary military service for 18-year-olds, tens of thousands of students across the country walked out of class in protest. And even though only 34% of French people say they trust their national government, nearly three-quarters said they supported Mr. Macron's voluntary military initiative, according to an ELAB poll, and 89% hold a positive view of the military more generally. Observers say those figures represent a generalized perception of threat across Europe that outweighs other factors. This year, Poland announced it was introducing large-scale military training for every adult male. And in late October, Croatia announced it would reintroduce conscription after 17 years of voluntary service. Meanwhile, the Ukraine war has revived Britain's desire to seek closer cooperation with the EU, with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer alongside Mr. Macron leading the proposed Coalition of the Willing peacekeeping initiative in Ukraine. We need a European way to defend and prepare for war, says Mr. Kinses of the German Marshall Fund. The effort needs to be not just about spending, but making defense part of the societal model. It's all about adapting to new threats. And again, this particular article was by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. Still in the world section, our next headline reads, Amid Destruction, a Determination to Live. Every time I go to Ukraine, I come across scenes of yet more extraordinary human resilience. The date on this article is December the 18th, and it is by Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. How is it possible to bring new visual insight to a war as vast, destructive, and comprehensively photographed as the continuing Russian onslaught against Ukraine? That is the challenge every time I visit Ukraine and its front lines and raise my cameras to record what I see. I have been in Ukraine 12 times during this current conflict, which will enter its fifth year in February 2026. And every time, just when I think there can be little new visual storytelling left to do, I come across scenes of yet more extraordinary human resilience, of resolute coping, and of finding life in a place where the term normal life has become an oxymoron. That sense came to me during a Russian double missile attack on a vast food warehouse on the edge of Ukraine's battered northeastern city of Kharkiv in July. I heard the missiles land while reporting not far away, and then our team followed the column of smoke to the civilian target. Firefighters everywhere are built tough, but those in Kharkiv, just 25 miles from the Russian border, have to manage the carnage from almost daily Russian bombardments. Inside, the scene took on apocalyptic proportions, with the floor slick with spilled cooking oil and water and smoke that glowed with fire. One firefighter, pushed to exhaustion, stepped away from the blaze for better air and a drink of water. When he knelt down, he had the reddened eyes of a fire warrior on an endless mission. His look of fatigue captured for me the grave weight of what he must do every day to keep his fellow citizens safe. Other images encapsulate the human toll and the life in Ukraine that still laughs and carries on despite the war. There are soldiers on a snow-frozen front line and drone pilots deeply buried in their dugouts, their whole world confined to aerial scenes on screens. In Kyiv, a flag-packed memorial numbs from the sheer density of fallen soldiers and the emotions they evoke. Yet there are photos also of schoolgirls with painted hands for an art project, their classroom not far from advancing Russians. A marriage and smiles, too, are shared unexpectedly close to the war. One couple express gratitude after being evacuated from their burning frontline town. But the quintessential image of resilience I captured this year is Bogdana Zupania, who surveyed the remains of a Kyiv apartment she owned after a drone strike when she was just 2 weeks from giving birth to new life. And again, that's a brief article by Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move on to the USA section of today's Monitor. And our first headline from the USA section reads, Foiled L.A. Terror Plot Highlights Mishmash of Beliefs That Can Fuel Violence. Experts say a thwarted New Year's Eve attack in the Los Angeles area shows politically motivated violence isn't confined to a pure ideology. The date on this article is December the 19th. It is by Ali Martin, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is Los Angeles. The FBI said Monday that it had stopped a series of attacks planned for New Year's Eve in Southern California. The alleged plotters, say law enforcement officials, are members of a far-left anti-capitalist, anti-government organization that had targeted companies engaged in activities affecting interstate and foreign commerce. This country protects the right to hold extreme views about its past, present, and future. But violence is an unmistakable and enforceable line, says Assistant Attorney General for National Security John Eisenberg in a news release. Federal and local law enforcement worked together on the case, and experts say the foiled plot underscores the success of interagency collaboration. It is also a reminder, they say, that extremism is not bound to a particular side of the political spectrum. It can arise from any social or political ideology. Federal authorities charged 4 people from the greater Los Angeles area with conspiracy and possession of unregistered destructive devices for allegedly planning to use pipe bombs on 2 U.S. businesses as well as to target immigration and customs enforcement agents. The defendants, officials say, are members of the Turtle Island Liberation Front, which describes itself on social media as seeking liberation through decolonization and tribal sovereignty. Turtle Island is a term for North America used by some indigenous people. Instagram posts by the organization, which aligns itself with pro-Palestinian activists, calls for decolonization, and one post reads, "Peaceful protest will never be enough." Law enforcement says the account is run by Audrey Carroll, one of the defendants. Threat experts who spoke with The Monitor say their knowledge of the group is limited to the information made public by federal authorities. It's hard to know how significant it was and what in the end were the aims, says Randolph Hall, director of the Center for Risk and Economic Analysis of Threats and Emergencies at the University of Southern California. Court documents describe a manifesto the group circulated titled Operation Midnight Sun, which lays out plans to use improvised explosive devices at 5 potential targets. A task force arrested the group during the planning phase in the Mojave Desert, where the defendants were assembling bombs, according to the affidavit, which also says Ms. Carroll told a confidential informant that the plot will be considered a terrorist act. The arrest points to a recent increase in leftist extremism, says Lorenzo Vidino, director of the Program on Extremism at the George Washington University. While some people may remember the Weather Underground bombings of the early 70s, leftist violence since then has not been terrorist in nature, says Dr. Vidino. But in the last couple of years, that dynamic has changed, and we see more and more of this. A study from the Center for Strategic and International Studies shows spikes in left-wing attacks over the last decade and a sharp decline in right-wing incidents in the past year. While political violence happens all over the world, the United States, Dr. Vidino says, is experiencing more than other Western countries. It is more polarized, he said. America is distinct in ways that overlap with the increased polarization. First, law enforcement is aggressive in its pursuit of violent extremists, which allows for a pretty intense level of scrutiny of some of these dynamics, he says. Second, access to weapons is relatively easy. Third, America's First Amendment allows for protection of speech that is very extreme and can therefore allow people to recruit other people to extend their message to a broader audience. But having an outlet to express extreme ideas can also be an alternative to violence, he adds. While some conflict may lead to violence, most does not, says Dr. Hall. You can look at specific incidents where there's a connection, but it hasn't become, say, pervasive in society that people are battling with each other with guns or fists over political issues, he says. Extremism is springing from an increasingly complex mishmash of beliefs, says Mike Downing, chief security officer at private security firm Prevent Advisors. It's not a pure ideology on one side or pure ideology on the other side, but it's a mixed bag of things that are used to justify certain actions, how they got radicalized, how they mobilized to violence, says Mr. Downing, who ran counterterrorism operations in Los Angeles as a former deputy police chief of the city. The FBI calls it nihilistic violent extremism, mostly people who are young and online 24/7, who pick and choose from extremist beliefs. An extremist probably 50 years ago was reading long manuals, philosophical treatises. Today, it's TikTok, says Dr. Vidino. They simplify things a lot, and they also have a fascination with ultraviolence. A narrow focus on whether violence comes from one end of the political spectrum over another can lead law enforcement to overlook threats, says Mr. Downing. We just have to be careful that we don't get lured into this false sense of security by saying, oh yeah, the evolution of these threats are only coming from one side. It is possible to change a culture of violence, says Dr. Hall. The ability to resolve disputes peacefully with the kinds of institutions that favor dialogue and rule of law, trust in the legal system, these things are all important. Elected and civic leaders can set the tone. It's important for all those in the political sphere who have the ability to influence to diffuse the conflict that exists, he says. I think that's very valuable. The Southern California arrests show how law enforcement agencies can successfully work together when their authority is not politicized, says Mr. Downing. Engagement like community policing and teaching people about the terrorism landscape diminishes the motivation for extremists. And if you diminish both the motivational part of it and the capacity part of that, he says, you reduce the risk of terrorism. And again, this particular article was written by Allie Martin, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Still from the USA section of today's Monitor, the next headline reads, the next step was citizenship. Then these immigrants were pulled out of line. In Boston and other cities, some lawful permanent residents are having their naturalization ceremonies canceled amid a Trump administration review of applicants from 19 countries identified as posing high security risks. The date on this article is December the 19th. It is by Victoria Hoffman and Cameron Pugh, both of whom are staff writers at the Monitor. The dateline is Boston. For immigrants, naturalization ceremonies represent the culmination of their years-long effort to earn citizenship. In front of a federal judge, permanent residents raise their right hand, repeat the oath of allegiance to their new country, and usually wave a small American flag with pride once the judge confirms their citizenship. On December 4th, inside Boston's Faneuil Hall, a historic site where revolutionaries like Sam Adams fostered the idea of American freedom, one such event took a turn. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services officers denied entry to several people who showed up for their naturalization ceremony, according to Project Citizenship, a nonprofit providing legal support for those seeking citizenship. Each of these individuals was from one of the 19 countries the Trump administration identified as high security risks under a December 2nd Department of Homeland Security memo, which mandated the immediate pausing and review of immigration applications from these countries, including Haiti, Afghanistan, and Venezuela. What happened at the Boston ceremony is part of a tightening of the naturalization process throughout the country. In late November, New York State Attorney General Letitia James wrote a letter to the USCIS questioning its decision to cancel ceremonies in several counties in her state. USCIS said the counties did not meet the statutory requirements. On December 9th in Indianapolis, 38 out of 100 prospective citizens were turned away at their ceremony, according to local news reports. Local outlets in Atlanta reported that on December 12th, three immigrants had their oath ceremonies canceled. The effort to clamp down on legal immigration pathways followed the shooting of two National Guard members in Washington, one fatally, just before Thanksgiving. An Afghan national who entered the country legally in 2021 through a program for allies who served alongside the U.S. military has been charged with first-degree murder. Following that attack, President Donald Trump quickly announced significant immigration restrictions, including a pause on all asylum decisions. This week, the Trump administration added 20 countries to a list of nations whose citizens face full or partial bans on entering the U.S. Those who apply for naturalization are some of the most thoroughly vetted immigrants in the country. To be eligible, an immigrant must generally have been a lawful permanent resident for at least 5 years, be a person of good moral character, and pass tests in civics and English. The process can take decades, and the oath ceremony is largely seen as a formality. Gail Breslow, the executive director of Project Citizenship in Boston, says that 21 clients of the organization had their naturalization ceremonies canceled this month. Clients were either pulled out of line at the December 4th ceremony or notified via email that their ceremony scheduled for December 4th or December 10th had been canceled. One client who was turned away in person has lived in the U.S. for more than 20 years, Ms. Breslow said. She's been background checked, she's been fingerprinted, she's had her photo taken, she's been tested on her knowledge of U.S. civics. This is someone who has already been told that they've been approved for citizenship. In Minneapolis, naturalization ceremonies have also been canceled in recent weeks, says Jane Gropman, executive director of the International Institute of Minneapolis, which provides legal services for immigrants. Only 4 of the organization's clients have been granted citizenship this month, compared with the typical 40 to 70. In addition, the Institute has documented more than 60 cases since November of immigrants who received fee waivers for their citizenship application, having officials from the USCIS Fraud Division show up at their homes to review documents such as tax records and mortgages, according to Ms. Gropman. In a statement to the Monitor, a USCIS spokesperson said the agency has paused all adjudications for aliens from high-risk countries while it works to ensure that all aliens from these countries are vetted and screened to the maximum degree possible. The pause will allow for a comprehensive examination of all pending benefit requests for aliens from the designated high-risk countries, the statement said. The safety of the American people always comes first. Immigration lawyers and advocates have condemned the cancellations as unnecessary and cruel. By the time you actually get to the ceremony, you've gone through so many steps and so many processes, you already feel like you're an American, says Jeffrey Thielman, president and CEO of the International Institute of New England, which supports immigrants and refugees. It's discouraging to people, and it also creates more anxiety among the immigrant populations. The actions from the Trump administration come at a time when national support for the president's handling of immigration is dwindling. A recent poll by the Associated Press and ORC Center found that approval of Mr. Trump's immigration policies has dropped from 49% in March to 38% in early December. Over the last year, the White House has made illegal immigration a focal point in its agenda, from large-scale immigration and customs enforcement operations to the mobilization of National Guard troops, the Border Patrol, and other federal agencies to assist immigration enforcement officers. Now, USCIS recent policies are restricting legal immigration pathways, posing roadblocks for those seeking citizenships. Jeannie Kane, a lawyer at Kane Immigration, suggests that the cancellation of naturalization ceremonies is the tip of the iceberg on the possible outcomes from the USCIS memorandum. Under Section 1447B of Title 8 of the U.S. Code, those pulled from the naturalization ceremonies need to be certified as citizens within 120 days of their citizenship interview. Ms. Kane suggests that legal action is likely to be taken on behalf of those whose ceremonies have been canceled. Her greater concern is that for those from the 19 high-risk countries who have pending asylum cases or are seeking green cards. I have a client who has been waiting since 2014 for a decision on their asylum case, and he's not going to get a decision. Ms. Kane also worries that the number of high-risk countries will increase. It's not clear yet whether nationals who are already in the U.S., but from the latest countries added to the Trump administration's travel ban, will also face additional vetting for their asylum, green card, or citizenship applications. The Trump administration might also be intensifying efforts to revoke citizenships from some who have already been naturalized. USCIS field offices have been asked to identify 100 to 200 denaturalization cases per month in the 2026 fiscal year, according to recent reports in the New York Times. On December 10th, another ceremony was held at John Joseph Moakley U.S. Courthouse in Boston, days after the Faneuil Hall ceremony where immigrants were turned away. Jane Ellis, one of many volunteers that helped new citizens register to vote, said that extra volunteers were called in the event of a similar disruption. I just cannot imagine people going through all the steps that they have to do to get to this point, and to be turned away is just horrific, says Ms. Ellis, who began volunteering during the first Trump administration. I can't even get my head around it, she said. Supporters of the administration's immigration policy see tighter restrictions as a boon. Laura Rees, director of the Border Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation, published a report this month calling for a new immigration system that prioritizes Americans first, lawful immigrants second, and illegal aliens not at all. In short, lawful applicants who are eligible for an immigration benefit should have it granted in a timely manner, and those who are not eligible should be denied expeditiously and then promptly depart the U.S., Ms. Rees writes. Immigration advocates such as Ms. Breslow criticized the recent Trump administration policies for targeting people based on nationality, which she calls xenophobic and racist. Of the 19 high-risk countries, most are in Africa or the Middle East. These are people who've made their lives here. They're our neighbors. They're our co-workers. They're people we sit next to on the bus and the subway, she says. Naturalization ceremonies have long been a beacon of hope to immigrants seeking the American dream. Munifa Prosnitz, who was originally from Brazil, has lived in the U.S. for 9 years. She walked into Moakley Courthouse last week as a permanent resident and left as a U.S. citizen. After receiving her citizenship certificate, Ms. Prusnitz said she felt free. "I don't know how to explain it. It feels so good. Now I can vote. I can serve the country. I can do something to be better here." And again, this particular article was by Victoria Hoffman and Cameron Pugh, both of whom are staff writers at The Monitor. Moving on to the commentary section of today's Monitor, we'll pick up a comment or two. The first one, the headline reads, "Germany's Defense of European Values." The country has moved to boost military commitments and is outspoken about holding Russia accountable for its aggression in Ukraine. This candor affirms a growing willingness to step out of history's shadow and shine the light of democracy. The date on this comment is December the 18th, and it is by the Monitor's editorial board. In Germany, a national culture of remembrance, conscious of never repeating the horrors of Nazi militarism, is confronting the imperative of rearmament to support a reassertion of Europe's core values. As Russia continues to wage war on Ukraine, Germany's cultural shift offers guideposts to effectively defending Europe's security, as well as its liberal democratic traditions. Earlier this month, the German parliament voted to add more than 70,000 new troops to its army by 2035. This week, it passed the largest defense appropriation to date at £50 billion, nearly $60 billion. At this writing, Chancellor Friedrich Merz is seeking to convince other European leaders to exercise a difficult option, using frozen Russian financial assets as collateral for loans to Ukraine's beleaguered government. Each of these moves carries risks. Domestically, as a Monitor news article recently reported, there is little appetite for military service among young Germans. Regionally, using the Russian assets, most of which are held by the Belgium-based Euroclear Group, could carry monetary and reputational cost. Russia has just filed a $230 billion lawsuit against Euroclear in Moscow. And internationally, Europe as a whole is confronting a fraying relationship with the United States. Merz well understands the Russian threat to Europe, risks to the transatlantic alliance from Washington, and the economic opportunities of becoming a European defense hub, noted an analyst with the Atlantic Council this summer. And most importantly, he's prepared to do something about it. This willingness to act underscores the German leader's view that there is much at stake and that Western Europe's largest country, both by population and economic power, needs to step up to the demands. Timidity is not an option. Ukraine's fate is the fate of all Europe, he said last week, urging European Union members to show they are capable of standing together and acting to defend our own political order. Germany's military spending will help its neighbors as more than 90% of it involves purchases from European industry. Mr. Merz also spoke with conviction to German citizens about the rapid military and mindset transformation he believes is needed to counter Russia's overt and covert threats to regional stability. Even as American envoys shuttle between Russia and Ukraine and European leaders, Mr. Merz has urged the U.S. president to focus on elements for a lasting peace, which would include holding Russia accountable for the damage and loss for nearly 4 years of war. Germany's newfound confidence and recognition of its potential for positive impact is reassuring to Ukraine and European allies. But it is also encouraging to its own people, signaling a readiness to move out of the shadow of the past while still using its lessons to chart a future based on moral clarity and democratic values. And again, that was a commentary by the Monitor's editorial board. And we're going to do a second one here because it seems like it's on an important topic that is, you know, disturbing a lot of us these days. The headline reads, "An America Yearning for the Sacred in Civic Life." At the state level, many elected officials speak openly about how they rely on ethics and faith to navigate partisan challenges. They might be shaping a, quote, better way for voters to relate to each other. The date on this particular commentary is December the 16th, and it is again by the Monitor's editorial board. Many Americans feel buffeted by a cycle of tit-for-tat political rhetoric, whipsaw policymaking, and norms breaking. A recent poll found that 82% of voters believe the way people talk about politics contributes to violence. Only one-third say it is possible to lower the temperature on political rhetoric. Yet in recent weeks, more voices are calling for civic civility. They are based on a mix of political principles as well as moral and religious values. On December 9th, for example, two governors, a Democrat and a Republican, clasped hands after modeling respectful political dialogue at the National Cathedral in Washington. Democrat Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania and Republican Spencer Cox of Utah both often share how their faith traditions imbue their public service. Speaking to the Washington Post, Mr. Cox noted, "Bridge building is the hardest thing I've ever done. It takes strong faith and strong courage." A couple of days later, a bipartisan group of Indiana state senators voted down a bill that would have redrawn an electoral map to skew the state's current 7-2 Republican advantage in Congress to 9-0. Several cited an ethical desire to reduce partisanship. "I hope that this is the beginning of the country stepping back from the brink," said one Republican state senator. Such a stance fits research that shows how the words and actions of elected officials can cue either positive or negative public sentiment. A Cornell University political scientist who has studied the campaign approach of Mr. Cox, who refuses to demonize opponents, found that it had a significant positive effect on public views. "Americans look to political leaders for moral clarity," says Governor Shapiro. "Elected officials in a few states appear to recognize this as they decide whether to push redistricting to lock in House wins in 2026 or whether to abide by political norms." Texas kicked off a redistricting race mid-year, redrawing maps to favor Republican candidates. California responded with a referendum to override an independent commission and draw maps that would favor Democrats. "California's gerrymandering is not fighting back, it's cheating," Democrat Patricia Sine of the California Citizens Redistricting Commission said about the Proposition 50 referendum that passed in November. "It's not all just about getting reelected," Kansas State Representative Brett Fairchild, a Republican, told the New York Times. "It's also about principles and morals and ethics." Many Americans might now be seeking deeper values that can guide civic life. In the dialogue series that hosted Mr. Cox and Mr. Shapiro and similar events, for example, the National Cathedral has laid out one approach. "We start with two fundamental ideas," its website notes. "First, every person is a beloved child of God, regardless of who they vote for. And second, Americans yearn for a better way to be in relationship with one another." Perhaps the yearning has found its voice. And again, that's a commentary by the Monitor's editorial board. With that, we're going to move on to the economy section of today's Monitor and pick up a headline. And the headline is, "Quitting on My Own Terms, Why More Women Are Exiting the Workforce." Shifts in workplace policies like a pullback from remote and hybrid work launched during the pandemic appears to be creating a tough year for women in the U.S. workforce. The date on this article is December 16th, and it is by Victoria Hoffman, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. Vases of flowers and notes scribbled with messages of support are scattered throughout Hannah Kim's home in Goodyear, Arizona. Her friends and family sent them after she announced her decision to leave her job. Ms. Kim left a role as a marketing executive at an insurance carrier on December 1st after months of stricter in-person work requirements and a long commute to Phoenix made it difficult for her to maintain the care she provides to her mother at home. "I feel like it was a decision that could have been avoided if the company were more about flexibility and met different kinds of employees' needs," says Ms. Kim, who was originally hired to work remotely. Ms. Kim is part of a movement of women who are leaving their jobs. More than 330,000 women aged 20 and older have left the workforce this year, according to an analysis by the National Women's Law Center. In the first half of 2025, the employment rate of mothers of children under five declined by its steepest drop in four decades, according to researcher to research by Misty Hagenis, an associate professor at the University of Kansas who studies gender economics. The past year brought unusual pressure for employees and the highest level of discontent in 5 years, noted a recent report on women in the U.S. workforce by Lean, Inc., a women's advocacy group, and McKinsey and Company consultants. Return-to-work mandates, a federal rollback under the Trump administration of diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, including some geared toward women, and a shortage of affordable care for dependents are all affecting whether women stay on the job, says Jasmine Tucker, vice president of research at the National Women's Law Center in Washington. The trends over time are not looking good, says Ms. Tucker. We say leaving the labor force, and it sounds like it's an option, but I think the reality is that they have been shoved out. Not everyone views a pullback of women from the paid workforce, labor force, negatively. Popular right-wing podcasters like Ali Beth Stuckley and Alex Clark talk about the benefits of mothers prioritizing time with their children and say societal norms put too much pressure on women to put their careers first. During the pandemic, remote or flexible work helped usher some women into the workforce. In 2023, the percentage of prime-age working women in the 25 to 54 age range reached an all-time high of 75.3%, driven largely by an increase of college-educated women with young children. Many employers this year retreated from the remote and hybrid work that was infused into certain professional roles during the COVID-19 pandemic. The federal government required employees to return to 5 days in office, as did Amazon for its corporate staff. One study found that more than half of Fortune 100 workers this year had fully in-person policies for the first time since the pandemic. The Lean, Inc. and McKinsey report published last week found that one quarter of 124 companies surveyed reported scaling back or discontinuing remote or hybrid work this year. A flexibility stigma is one of the big factors holding women back from work, according to the report's authors, who found that employees who use flexible work arrangements are seen as less committed and are less likely to receive promotions or sponsorships. At the same time, costs of both childcare and elder care are rising faster than inflation, which puts pressure on individuals to decide whether they can afford to remain in the workforce. In two-parent households, when we can't afford the cost of childcare, we usually send the person who is the lower income earner home to take care of the kids, says Jessica Kriegel, chief strategy officer at Culture Partners, a consultancy group. That affects women, she adds, since the pay gap between the genders has grown for the past 2 years. In addition, she notes, about 80% of single-parent households are headed by women. Views on how to help women and men balance professional work with caregiving responsibilities range from greater child care support to more tax credits for parents. Last month, New Mexico became the first state to provide universal government-funded child care for all families, regardless of income, using funding from state oil and gas reserves. New York's incoming mayor, Zoran Mamdani, campaigned on a promise of universal child care. At the federal level, the tax and spending bill passed by Congress over the summer includes several provisions meant to support working families. Those include a permanent extension of the child tax credit, increased tax credits for employers who provide child care assistance, and tax advantage savings accounts for children known as Trump accounts. Policymakers can offer support by investing in parental leave and high-quality, affordable child care, subsidized by the government, says Professor Hagenis at the University of Kansas. Mothers and unpaid family caregivers, that group of individuals in our society, are too big for us to fail them, she says. Critics of universal child care raise concerns about funding quality and the impact on children. Vice President J.D. Vance, while running for Senate in 2021, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal criticizing a Biden administration proposal to spend $225 billion on child care as harmful to children. Other studies show high-quality early childhood benefiting children academically and socially. Young children from average healthy homes can be harmed by spending long hours in child care, Mr. Vance wrote. Our democracy might be comfortable with the trade-offs here, higher gross domestic product and more parents, especially women in the workforce on the one hand, and unhappier, unhealthier children on the other. But we ought to be honest and acknowledge that these trade-offs exist. Dr. Hegenis expects the labor participation rate for women to rebound. Women and mothers in particular tend to be very resilient, she says. Women will look for other ways to get back into work. Ms. Kim in Arizona believes she made the best decision she could for herself and for her family, despite initially feeling as if she was giving up on a career that she had worked so hard to get. Shortly after leaving her corporate job, she launched her own marketing consultancy, fending off her self-doubt about leaving a steady paycheck and focusing on the control she's gained over her schedule. When she decided it was time to pack up her office, Ms. Kim posted about her decision online. Her post gathered more than 2,000 likes and 250 comments. Her private messages filled up with other women who left their jobs to provide care for loved ones, telling her she wouldn't regret her decision. There was a second that I was thinking, maybe this is crazy, she says. I'm just trying to do what I know how to do and do it on my own terms. It feels really gratifying. And again, this particular article was by Victoria Hoffman, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. We have a little bit of time left, so I'm going to jump over to the book section and give you a few of the books listed as the 10 best books for the month of December. While away the darkest days of the year, solving mysteries, enjoying a holiday romance, and catching up with a country music icon. So the date on this is December the 16th, and it is by Monitor Reviewers. So these are the fiction titles our reviewers like best this month. When the Fireflies Dance by Aisha Hassan. Aisha Hassan's novel follows Lalu, a kind-hearted 20-year-old scraping by in Lahore, Pakistan, as a driver for a wealthy clan. His goal is simple, and readers soon learn, nigh impossible, to save enough money to free his family from their indentured labor as brickmakers. The fast-moving story rebukes an unjust system with heart to spare. And that's a review by Aaron Douglas. The next fiction, best fiction for the month, The Living and the Dead by Christopher Carlson. Set in Sweden, Christopher Carlson's absorbing tale of a teenage boy's murder after a late-night party investigates not merely a crime, but the ecosystem of missteps, sloppy professionals, buried secrets, compromised decisions, and vengeful acts that dogs the community and its young men in the years that follow. There's much to ponder about class, guilt, and obfuscation. And that particular review is also by Aaron Douglas. And the next one, The List of Suspicious Things by Jenny Godfrey. When 12-year-old Miv sets out to identify the Yorkshire Ripper, the serial killer who haunted England in the 1970s, her investigation uncovers the secrets that adults conceal every day, including racism and infidelity. The coming-of-age novel unwinds a tale not only of lost innocence, but also the sustaining power of friendship and family bonds. The reviewer is Joan Gaylord. And next title, Best of December Books, Yours for the Season by Uzma Jalaluddin. When lawyer Samira Malik meets chef Tom Cook at a holiday party, they later make an impromptu cooking video that goes viral, and a romance rumor grows. A faux-mance could benefit both their careers. When their families maneuver them to Alaska at Christmas, the antics multiply. Uzma Jalaluddin's warmth and wit make this a delightful intercultural rom-com. And that, the reviewer is Stephanie Milligan. The Italian Secret is the next in the best books. These are fiction books of December. Again, The Italian Secret by Tara Moss. When private investigator Billy Walker discovers a, a box harboring family secrets, she sails on a luxury liner from Sydney with her mother to post-war Naples to learn more. This Moorish historical mystery delivers intrigue, glamour, and romance as Billy's professional work becomes dangerously personal. And that's also a review by Stephanie Milligan. And with that, we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you spending some of your valuable time with me, listening to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I'll be back with more from the Christian Science Monitor next week. Thank you for listening.